www.infiniteconsciousness.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. Today we have with us a lady that's written a really interesting book, Dr. Laurie Nadel, and her book, The Sixth Sense. How are you, Laurie?
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me as a guest on your show.
Oh, just a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
So first of all, I want, obviously we're going to talk about intuition, so, and human consciousness, so I want to ask you two things.
Mm-hmm.
What is your definition of intuition, and what is your definition of consciousness?
Those are good questions. Intuition, we call it knowing without knowing how you know, and it's a sudden, instantaneous knowing of something without the conscious use of reasoning. And the consciousness, I like to think of as that cursor of awareness or attention, in which is where you focus your energy, your mental energy, your awareness, your attention, and it can flip from one intelligence to another intelligence, from a survival space to a spiritual space.
Mm-hmm.
And that consciousness, I think of as like a tiny little dot on the computer when you move your mouse.
So, you don't know this, but I've been asking certain questions to certain of the guests that I've been having coming on about this thing, what consciousness is. Do you think that consciousness is, could the word be replaced with awareness, or do you look at consciousness as being that thing of all there is?
I think that to be conscious, consciousness is often referred to as a higher state of a being or awareness.
Uh-huh.
But I think that your consciousness is where you put your attention.
Okay. So tell us, what is the difference between intuitive knowing and psychic abilities?
Well, many scientists have attributed their breakthroughs to an intuitive flash of knowing something that they didn't know before. And many of those breakthroughs were based on information or experience that a scientist had acquired through years of training, knowledge, experimentation, and so the source of the information or data that led to the intuitive breakthrough was acquired through the five physical senses.
What is the source?
What is the source of what?
The intuitive knowing.
Well, there are two types of intuitive knowing. There's one which was covered extensively in the book Blink, in which intuitive knowing is a kind of rapid cognition of information that's already been acquired through the five physical senses.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's what we normally think of as psychic intuitive insight, or knowing, where you have a flash of knowing about something that hasn't happened yet, perhaps, or about someone with whom you've had no physical contact. And you cannot explain the source of that information through the five physical senses.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the source of the information has downward causation?
Do I think of the source of the information as downward causation? Could you explain that?
Do you think that things start on like a, I hate to use this word frequency because so many of the scientists have a problem with it, but at a higher frequency, and like the idea just drops in by lowering frequency so that the brain can interpret it?
Sometimes.
Ideas, it comes all in one piece like that.
Well, sometimes I think it does. I think intuition, functions like a satellite dish in the brain, and
mm-hmm.
we're able to pick up, frequencies, if you like, images, impressions, in books, ideas, concepts that that are, we're tuned to something that, or attuned to something that can't, again, be identified through the, you know, objective or physical means, and that we pick up those frequencies or concepts or intuitive flashes because we receive them from someplace else.
Yeah, in just a second I'm going to start getting into your book, but I know that you know a lot of the science that's going on, such as, you know, Dean Radin's, you know, Entangled Minds and things like that. So I wanted to ask you a few things before we got into this, into your book. What do you think it is that we're picking up, and where does it come from?
Oh, if I knew the answer to that, I could just sit up on a throne and people would come and pay me lots of money to find the answer to that. I don't know.
Do you think perhaps that it's signaling of, you know, electromagnetic signaling that comes from maybe mass consciousness or God, perhaps, and that it comes in signaling and our brain interprets the signal?
Do I think
like
it's possible?
Yeah,
well, I think a lot of things are possible. I'll give you an example. Attended a seminar on dreams around September 11th, and there's a Jungian psychologist who said that in the 8 months prior to the terrorist attack, that over 100 people who were in analysis reported dreams of planes flying into buildings, bombs, people in New York City particularly, birds flying into towers, the images of the tower from the tarot, and that, in fact, that the idea of the attack already existed in what Jung would call the collective unconscious, and many people were dreaming about it because it existed in that form.
Who was it that was doing that study?
I'm sorry?
Who did that study? That's interesting.
I don't remember her name.
That's a really interesting study.
Well, it was very interesting because many of my clients had dreams that were, when I looked back a year or two later, one woman who lived downtown Manhattan had dreamt the attack in exact detail, including the direction from which it was coming, what
really?
Color the sky was, that people were running, you know, from the south up to the north. And she had dreamt it 13 months before the attack.
Amazing.
So
yeah, I didn't normally I ask people to give a little bit about themselves, but your topic was so interesting. I forgot to do that. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your background so they'll know what you do and where to find your information.
Oh, thank you. I have a dual career in psychology and journalism. My first career initially was in journalism, and then in the late 1980s, I started research for the book, which became Sixth Sense, and went back to school and got a combined master's and PhD in psychology and a second doctorate in clinical hypnotherapy. And somewhere in there, I had a near-death experience and was told that I would use my experience to help other people. So when I finished my degrees, I started working particularly in the area of trauma and helping people who have stress-related health conditions and post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was in a unique position in that I was writing for the New York Times at the time of September 11th. And
really?
I was able to report on the psychological aftermath of the attack and how it affected people a month and a year after the attack. And from that, I was hired to direct a program for teenagers whose parents were killed, each of whom had lost a parent in the World Trade Center attack. And I did that for 2.5 years. So I have a private practice in Manhattan and Long Island, and I also do telephone coaching and mentoring to support people who are going through spiritual emergencies or what I call spiritual burnout, need to redefine their lives and find purpose and meaning and experience themselves differently.
Oh my goodness, I'm going to have you back just to talk about those two things
Thank
right
you.
There.
Sure, I'd love to do that. And you can find more about me on www.unlockyoursixthsense.com.
Did you believe in near-death experiences before you had yours?
Well, I had read about them, but I'd worked in journalism for years, and I wrote a lot of stories about a lot of violent deaths of all kinds, and you get to be very kind of clinical about death until it's yours, and then it becomes very personal.
Mm-hmm.
So you're aware that this is one of those experiences where this is what happens when you die. And you see yourself, you're outside your body, and you,
mm-hmm.
You feel the severe pain of, what's going on. But, you're also aware that it's happening
to
you.
It's not physical pain, right? It's emotional pain, right?
Sorry?
It's not physical pain, it's emotional pain, right?
Well, no, it is physical pain.
After you die?
No. Well, the process of dying. The exit from the physical body was to get away from the pain.
Uh-huh.
And
So while you were, whatever happened to you, you were in a lot of pain.
Yeah, and I could see my body in spasms, once I was out of my body. But
did you go out of your body before it died?
I went out of my body while it was spasming, but it was actually much more interesting what happened, afterwards, mm-hmm. because there was a spirit in the room. There was a man's voice. I was there alone, and he told me that I wasn't meant to live with the pain. I was meant to recover. And then there was a door on the wall, which I thought was the tunnel that you go through to get to the white light,
mm-hmm.
but there was a force that was preventing me from going into that tunnel. And then this old, very ancient white form came out of the door, and he was a very he was an ancient Tibetan or Chinese spirit doctor who came into my body and basically healed me. I was having a severe asthma attack,
mm-hmm.
and opened up my lungs, and the next day the doctor told me that I should have been dead, and that when I was well enough I could get Social Security, and that I would never work again, and that my life was basically over.
Oh my God.
And
so
there's a long road back from there.
Did that radically change your perspective of the world like it does many people?
Well, it changed everything, but it wasn't I didn't have angels, and a lot of the literature is when I read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying,
mm-hmm.
He categorizes Soyog Rinpoche categorizes five or six different types of near-death experience, and one of them is the kind that I had, where you're not taken all the way into the light, but you're given message and communication that helps to redirect your life's purpose.
Did you come back with heightened intuitive abilities?
I wouldn't say that directly. I think that just kind of that started to happen after the birth of my daughter, and then my intuitive abilities had been kind of intermittent, mm-hmm. throughout my life.
Now, let's go into a little bit into your book now. You talk at the very beginning about Elaine, is it
De Beauport,
her multiple intelligence system. Tell us about that and what we have to learn from that, what it implies.
Well, Dr. Paul McLean, who was the chief of brain evolution for National Institute of Mental Health for many years, discovered that we have, it's called a triune brain, but it's actually four different brain systems that are functioning simultaneously, kind of like four different Windows applications on the computer.
Now, is this sectioned off in your brain, or is
they're
all happening all over at the same time?
No, they're sectioned off.
Okay.
They're autonomous. So we're talking now about brain and behavior, brain and cognition, how you think, how you feel, how you intuit. and not whether, you know, the right side or the left side of your body is managed by one side of the brain or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the left and right brains, as we know them, are just, you know, the top two brains in this kind of triune brain system. And what we normally think of as intelligence is the skills of the left brain, logic, language, you know, memory, ability to access information. And Elaine de Belport was, along with Howard Gardner at Harvard, the people who identified that each of these brains has its own network of intelligences, and each of these brains has its own way of processing information and making sure that, you can make decisions based on how each of those brains process information.
So
and some people have a natural tendency, say, you know, you might have musical ability, you may have athletic ability, you may have intuitive ability, but everyone has particular gifts and talents and strengths, and it basically breaks open and redefines the whole model of what the brain is and what intelligence is, and it looks at intuition as a natural mental ability that we can develop.
Now, how was he able to define this? Was it with an MRI? Does the brain light up in certain areas, or how did he do it?
How do you do what?
How did he determine?
Well, he studied, he was a brain physiologist. I mean, they didn't have MRIs and PET scans and stuff in the 1950s.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of the work was done, you know, with the pathology. You know, he did a lot of work with forensics. He did a lot of work watching mammals and animals in their natural habitat, and a lot of the work was done, you know, with autopsies.
Interesting. So what does the limbic system have to do with intuitions or knowing?
Well, if you're familiar with the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which says that we have four functions that we use to gather information, and also to make decisions about the world. And when Carl Jung came up with his model that was based on 20 years of clinical experience in Switzerland, began in the 1920s, and he said that we have a sensing function, which corresponds to what we call the reptilian or the R-system brain. That's the brain of patterns, habits, and routines.
Mm-hmm.
We have the limbic system, which is now called the brain of emotional intelligence, which is also called, in Jungian terms, the feeling, the brain where we process our feelings. And then we have, you know, the so-called left and right brains, where the left brain is logic, or what they call the thinking function, and the right brain is considered to be traditionally the seat of intuition, which is, again, the ability to see around the corner, or the ability to see patterns or anticipate trends, or to see the need for something, product or service that hasn't existed before. And that's known as the N, or the intuitive function. Now, intuition can be combined with logic, or it can be combined with feeling. So when you see the big picture, or when you take in information through that satellite dish in the brain, which we will envision as being up there in the right brain, and you get a glimpse of something, you see the whole, then how do you evaluate what you see? Well, some people evaluate it logically, and some people will kind of run it through the filter of their value system and their subjective intelligence, which is what you find in the limbic system. So you can be an intuitive thinker, like, say, Albert Einstein, or Dr. Robert Jarvik, who I also interviewed for the book after he developed the Jarvik 7, or you can be an intuitive feeler, who is somebody who would have tremendous empathy and also the ability to anticipate the needs of people on individual or on a large collective scale.
Interesting. So how do you start? Oh, one thing I wanted to ask you. You talk about intuitive knowing with precedent and intuitive knowing without precedent. Tell the audience what you mean by that.
Well, that's what we were talking about before. You know, a scientist who has a breakthrough, for example, Archimedes, who was sitting in the bathtub and discovered the principles of displacement, and he had this eureka moment or this aha moment. That intuition came about as the result of a precedent of information that he'd acquired through the five physical senses. Whereas a mother who rushes home to prevent an accident, to prevent a child from pulling a pot, you know, boiling pot off a stove, when she was outside in the garden, that would be what we call intuition without a sensory-based precedent, because you really can't explain through the five physical senses how you got that information.
At least it's good to know there's some words to describe what's happening to you.
Right.
Because that confuses a lot of people. They don't know how to describe it.
Right, right. And that's one of the big problems that people have in the business world is that, you know, until you have kind of keywords that you can use that are, you know, non-threatening and kind of business-related.
Right.
Very often people are treated with ridicule or suspicion because they can't explain how they know what they know. I mean, their brain just functions differently.
Why would one need to suspend rational thought?
Well, you need to suspend that rational thought for a moment here and there, in order to, you know, it's really more a question of shifting your consciousness from the rational program over to the, you know, more intuitive, kind of the open-ended kind of intuitive program, because intuition is something that, you know, we kind of receive it. It's something because it's spontaneous. It's what Jung called a non-rational function. So you, instead of the kind of trying to figure things out in a linear way, if you stop doing that and you kind of go for a walk or you take a drive, you know, or you go to sleep on a problem, your intuition can kind of, you know, take the data and you know, synthesize it, crunch it, you know, run it through the washing machine and, you know, aha, all of a sudden you may just see the solution that you were trying to figure out rationally. It just seems to solve itself.
How can someone like an executive or someone in human resources use it on the go in their daily life at work? How can, because you know, you do need to do that thing, because it's almost like I like to describe it, the way I get my stuff is I hear it, and I have to say, you know, I can't hear two conversations at once, so you got to stop one of them. So how would you tell them to do that?
Well, I think the first thing is to think of a time when you had a strong hunch or gut feeling and you ignored it. Everybody's got those. And, you know, go back into that experience and step into it and re-experience it so that you're looking out through your own eyes and you see what you saw and hear what you heard and feel what you felt. And then, you know, get a sense of you know, where was that hunch coming from? Was it an inner voice? Was it something that you saw? Did something flash in front of your eyes? Did you feel it in your body? Was it like a gut feeling? Because everybody, you know, has a primary system, or an intuition has got its own language. Mm-hmm. And for some people see it, and some people hear it, and some people feel it. And you have to really get to know what your personal signal is, because a lot of men, for a lot of men, it's a warm sensation across their chest, whereas for women it might be a tightening in the abdominal area or the solar plexus, or some people get a tingling in their hands, or they feel something in the back of their neck. Mm-hmm. But the first step, I think, is to really remember when you had it, so that you can begin to zero in on what your personal signal is, so that you can rehearse that, and you can call it up when you need it.
How would you tell someone to develop it?
Well, it can be
developed.
Well, how can you develop? We have a lot of exercises in Sixth Sense, but I think the best way is, again, you know, define it for yourself so you know what it is. Identify your personal signal, and then the third step would be to pay attention so that you can recognize it when it happens. And then you can decide whether you're going to trust it or not, and keep a little log for the times that you trusted it, times that you ignored it. Mm-hmm. So that you'll know when you get that feeling in your chest or the tightening in your abdomen, or you know, you dream. Like when I dream and I see the color yellow in my dream, I've learned over years that is my intuition speaking to me in my dream, and I'd better wake up in that dream and pay attention, because I'm getting information about something that's going to happen, and it never fails. So I get this visual sense. I see this yellow, this bright yellow light, like sunlight, or kind of a golden color in the air, and I've learned to pay attention to that, because it's always
so
right.
You pay attention like the next day when you wake up about what's going on.
I pay attention in my dream, and then I'll wake up. I'll remember the dream. And then I'll take some notes so that I can think about, you know, who or what it's connected to. And, you know, sometimes if it involves someone I know, I will always, you know, call that person or email them and tell them that I had a dream and that, you know, that there's something that they needed to be careful about. And it's always turned out to be right.
You talk in your book about gut feelings. You know, everybody has those things, but you also talk about there being some science behind why you get that gut feeling.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of research since this book came out that there are hormones that are linked to the digestive system that are also they originate in the brain, but they use the gut or the abdominal area as a signaling field, and they've actually been able to pinpoint what some of those, you know, hormones are in the brain that are present when you have a gut feeling.
You know, I can't remember if it was Candace Pert that or HeartMath, but one of those people told me that the abdomen and each one of the organs are lined with neurons.
Right.
So when you have a particular emotion, it'll fire a particular, you know, neurotransmitter that's affiliated with that particular organ. And if it gets too much stimulation by that chemical, it'll get sick.
Right.
Or cause that gut feeling so that you know that something, if you feel that gut feeling, you need to know that you're firing hormones and doing something to yourself.
Right. Your voice keeps dropping out. I apologize. But
oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. I have kind of a quiet voice anyway.
Yeah, so do I. Now I can hear you better.
Till my kids start acting up like they were when we first called you.
Yeah. Know about that.
Yeah, I know it. Tell me about synchronicity and what the significance of that is. What is that?
Well, I like to think that synchronicity is when, you know, when you start thinking about somebody who you haven't seen in a long time, but you know, maybe were never particularly close to that person, but you can't get them out of your mind, or you have a song that takes you back to a particular time, and you might be, you know, unable to get the song out of your head, and then something strange happens, and you just, you know, run into that person for no apparent reason, and you realize, oh my God, I've been thinking about you for 2 weeks. And it seems kind of weird because, you know, there may not be any, like, aha moment as to why you've run into this person, but the fact is that you couldn't get them out of your mind before you met them. So that it's like there's a mental event that precedes the physical event. And Russell Targ, who was a physicist, you know, referred to synchronicity as a glitch in time. And he said that really we don't, you know, that physics doesn't have the tools to really understand how that happens. But it is a kind of intuition. It's like you're syncing up. Again, that satellite dish is picking up, you know, some kind of impression about someone who's path you're going to cross in the future, and you may not know why or how, but there's like an insistent quality to, there's a repetitive, obsessive quality to the thinking or the songs or the word to the song, and you don't know why you can't get this person literally out of your head, and then within a week or two, usually, your paths cross and the person pops up in your life.
What do you think is the significance of synchronicities?
Well, Jung called it a meaningful coincidence. And again, I think it's just one of those mysterious things that, you know, we can kind of marvel at and pay attention to. You know, sometimes they can guide us to, improving relationships or getting a new job or, you know, making a connection with someone who is going through something similar to what we are going through at a particular time. But a lot of the time the crossing of paths with somebody doesn't bear fruit. So it's really, I think, more of the internal event that gets us to pay more attention to what's going on in the mind. What are these intuitive flashes or signals like? And, you know, how can we get a better read on ourselves?
You know, one thing that I pay attention to in my life, and I found that when synchronicities do occur in my life, they usually occur in threes. And they usually come, there may be several sets of synchronicities going on at the same time. There'll usually be three of the same charge. Does that make sense? Three of the same kind of intensity. And if I listen to those things, it'll lead me to something that I've been trying to accomplish or some goal that I've been trying to reach. Have you noticed that?
No, not particularly. Not in my life, anyway.
I've read some physics on that, too, somewhere. I think Bill Tiller had something to say about that. I don't know why, but three has something seems to do with it.
Yeah, I haven't found them, to go in threes, but they are quite astounding when they happen.
They sure are.
And you can't say, gee, that was just a coincidence, because the odds of something like that happening are it's just so unlikely, and the subjective significance and the connection between the mental event and the physical event, you know, is a clear connection.
I want to ask you one question here that you've not talked about in your book, and how it relates to another question that you did talk about during your book. First question is, and I'll say them both first. Do you think there are gradients of conscious awareness, like David Hawkins writes about? And
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Have you read David Hawkins' book, Power versus Force?
No.
Oh, it's a great book. You should look that up someday. David, through kinesiology, has determined that there are 11 levels of conscious awareness. That's why some people, when you talk to them about a particular thing, particularly psychic phenomena, it's like talking to a telephone pole or a fundamental religious person. You know, they're not going to hear you. And then somebody else that's, you know, open to hearing what you're saying but don't really know. And then somebody else accepts it wholeheartedly. And then there's a level where people start reaching spiritual enlightenment, things like that. So you view the world differently. You know, you view the world as one. So things like that is what I mean by gradients of conscious awareness. Do you think that exists?
Do I think that's a what?
That it exists.
Well, of course there are gradients of conscious awareness that exist. I haven't identified them as such, but they definitely exist.
And I wanted to know if you thought it had any relationship to the multiple levels of intelligence that you talked about.
No. Somebody can have, tremendous, intuitive intelligence as an inventor. But, the source of their intuition may be completely sensory-based. So their intelligence may be, their intuition may be in the form of rapid cognition. Not everyone, there are people who are who can be intuitive and very manipulative, such as salespeople, can be excellent at reading people and motivating people to do what they want, and they're not necessarily in tune with the higher level of consciousness. So. I don't think that intuition is per se something that is more or less spiritual. It's an energy like electricity, and
right.
depends on the level of the person and what other things, you know, kind of, you know, what things your soul has contracted to do in this lifetime, what your, you know, what doors are going to open for you mentally and spiritually. A lot of things that we don't understand and we don't control.
Is there any kind of testing, like IQ testing, that can indicate whether your intuition level is more excessive or more available or not?
I love working with the Myers-Briggs, because that will definitely let you measure your intuition and even fine-tune and see the different areas of application. It will show you, you know, if you're more of an inventor, or if you're more of an, you know, if you're an extroverted intuitive, or if you're a mystic, or a philosopher, you know, all of those distinctions, how you have relationships with others, how your intuition plays a part in that, how you communicate. The Myers-Briggs has been around for a long time, and I think it gives the most comprehensive portraits of intuition in combination with logic, in combination with emotional intelligence and structure, and how we manage time or don't manage time, or how we make decisions or don't make decisions. So I think that, and you can see what the value, the monetary value, I'm sorry, the numerical value of your intuition is in relation to your other three functions, which are really your other three brains. So anybody can take it online now. It's available. I also give Myers-Briggs in telephone mentoring sessions and support sessions, and we work with it, you know, very extensively. Another thing that's wonderful, which is covered in Chapter 6 of the Sixth Sense, is the Hermann Brain Dominant Instrument, which gives you a circular graph that shows you how your intelligences are distributed through the four different brain systems, and it also looks at different correlations of intuition with regard to analysis or interpersonal intelligence. And you can go to, I think the website is listed in the back of the book, I think it's hbdi.com, or you can go to Ned Hermann International.
Can you change the way your brain operates?
Oh, sure. Of course you can.
With practice, I guess?
Of course you can. You can develop areas of the brain. And in fact, many people learned to turn off their intuition when they were younger, because it was just, you know, they were ostracized, or they just, you know, it didn't get them as much reward or as much success as when they were using sequential thinking, or black and, you know, kind of logical linear thinking. You know, when they get to be adults, they want to turn it on again. So they start reading books. They want to come to classes. They want, you know, they want to know how they can recover, really, what their natural intuitive ability is.
Well, some of them do. I met a man the other day, and we were having the nicest conversation until he found out that I had this ability, and he just didn't want to talk to me anymore.
Really? Well,
just
he must
did
have been
not
threatened.
He just had wanted nothing to do with it. He thought it was of the devil.
Oh, I've had people come up and tell me I was teaching the work of the devil. It's very disturbing.
It really is.
Yeah.
You know, for people who don't believe it, there are actually physiological things that occur, aren't
right.
there? Can you tell us about that?
Well, there's been so much new research right now that, you know, they know that the, you know, the harmonics of the left and the right brain change. You know, now with PET scans, they can show which areas of the brain actually light up during meditation, during someone having a hunch or a gut feeling. It's very exciting. It's not, there's also a lot of distinction and difference. It used to be very straightforward. People would think, well, the left brain does this and the right brain does that. And apparently, you know, all parts of the brain are engaged when we are using our intuition.
So you talk a little bit about visualization. One thing I've always thought a lot about is when you're visualizing trying to create math or create that thing that you want to happen in your life, do you visualize the steps that it takes to get there, or do you visualize the end product?
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, well, with intuition, you know, people who are intuitive tend to see the result, you know, as a whole. It's like if you asked, you know, your logical mind to show you a shoe, it would tell you all the components of the shoe and how much it costs and what it's made out of and, you know, how many stitches it took, and the right brain will just show you the shoe and you'll see the whole. And so very often, you know, people who use their intuition to come up with solutions to problems, it's not so much that they consciously, you know, there were something like 28 different types of imagery in the brain that we're capable of. And conscious visualization is only one of them. Now, intuition is actually spontaneous visualization, so mm-hmm. It's not something that you're constructing. It's something that you're receiving.
But
so it's a whole different ball game, and it doesn't usually. It may show you some of the steps, you know, that you need to take to get there, but it usually shows you the end result.
Okay, I guess maybe I was asking something a little bit outside the box there. You know,
you were asking about you know, creative visualization.
How to get what it is that you want when people use creative visualization.
I'm really not the best expert to talk to about that. excuse me.
Bless you.
Just for a whole bunch of reasons. Usually, I think that, you know, when I work with people, we have to clear out a lot of debris of old beliefs and feeling fears, and we have to create a lot of empowering new beliefs before we get around to designing a blueprint of what we want. Also, very often, and I find this so often with people, including myself, we don't know what we want. And usually when we get what we want, it's not what we want anyway, or then we want something else. And
right.
The Buddha said that, in fact, one of the reasons why we suffer as human beings is because we're addicted to wanting.
Yes.
And I always ask people to throw away the word want and to really ask at a very deep level, you know, what are my needs and what are my deeper needs, and, you know, what are my spiritual needs, or what does God need for me to know or to do or to have, because then the rest of it will follow. And I don't encourage people to go after what they want, because it's usually just going to create more wanting.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, before I ask you my last question, I want to ask you if you have any interesting story that you've ran across in your work with this that you would like to share.
Well, I have a lot of stories.
I'm sure you do.
And I would really, you know, love to encourage people to get the book. There is a bonus offer that I have going on now for the next few days. And if you go to www.unlockyoursixthsense.com/letter.html, it will take you to the bonus offer, which I've teamed up with Dr. Wayne Dyer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you buy Dr. Laurie Nadell's Sixth Sense through Barnes & Noble, we have a link to buy the book. You'll get a special report on your intuitive profile, which tells you a lot about how to identify what your intuitive partner is, in terms of are you an introverted or extroverted intuitive? Do you combine your intuition with thinking or feeling? How does your intuition affect your choice of a workspace?
Mm-hmm.
There's also an MP3 audio, an essay that I've written for the Huffington Post called What I Didn't Tell Oprah.
That was going to be my last question.
Uh-huh. And another bonus that we have a couple of others, including a offering an additional week of coaching and mentoring for anybody who is interested in helping, getting help and support.
That's wonderful.
Getting through a life crisis.
That's wonderful.
So please, you know, if you'd like to check into this, it's you can go to unlockyoursixthsense.com/letter.html and click on the bonus offer. And we also have some amazing excerpts and audio from Dr. Wayne Dyer's forthcoming book, which is Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life, Living the Wisdom of the Tao.
That's amazing for you to do that, Lori. That's great. But now you got to tell us what you didn't tell Oprah.
Well, what I didn't tell Oprah was what really started me on this trail of exploring my sixth sense was that I was a reporter, and I had an apartment in Manhattan that actually was haunted, only I didn't know when I rented it that it was haunted. There was a Murphy bed, which is a pull-down bed, and when I first put my put my bed near where the Murphy bed was, I could hear this old person's voice talking about was old and sick and dying, and everybody that she knew was dying, and she was going to die too, and nobody cared. And the voice kept me up all night, and it was just gave me this very weird, clammy feeling. And it happened again the second night, so I thought, well, you know, maybe something happened in this corner. I never had an experience like that. So I moved the bed over to the other side of the apartment, and there was no voice, and I slept fine. And I thought, oh, no, that can't be, because, you know, I just had no experience of anything like this before. I just thought, that's crazy. I moved my bed back to where the closet was, and that voice started up again. So I shifted the bed back to the other side of the room, and then about a few weeks later in the morning, a bright red eye formed on that wall where the Murphy bed was and where the old person's voice was. And at that point, I thought I was really having a breakdown, except everything in my life was normal, except I heard this voice and I had seen this red eye on the wall in broad daylight, and there was someone else with me, and he had seen it also, so I knew I wasn't, you know, totally hallucinating. And I was introduced to somebody, and I explained to her what had happened, and she referred me to the American Society for Psychical Research, where one of their researchers told me that the red eye was a sign that my sixth sense was opening and that the other side was trying to communicate with me. And that was pretty shocking because it was like 1973 or 74, and I wanted to know why it just couldn't use the telephone or Western Union. I thought, and she said, well, have you seen the white lights yet? And I said, well, what do you mean, the white lights? She said, well, usually after the red eye, you see the white lights, and, you know, then all these things, you know, will start, you know, communicating to you from the other side. And I wasn't, I was kind of fascinated and repelled. But there was no information really available at that time other than some very old literature. And so it started me on what became a lifelong search to understand, you know, what the sixth sense was and why it was possible for somebody who had no beliefs and who had no training and who had no experience, why it was somebody like myself, mm-hmm, who was not predisposed to that, could have an experience where you could see and hear and receive messages and communication that could clearly not be explained through the five physical senses. And that's what led me to write Sixth Sense, and that's kind of what has led me to continue my journey and studies and exploration and some fascinating people, both on the scientific end of the spectrum and also with shamans and spiritual healers in South America. So I've been very fortunate.
So do you continue to hear, or was that the only time?
Oh, sometimes I'll hear. Sometimes I get messages from you know, people on the other side in dreams, and mm-hmm, sometimes I get messages for people when I'm meditating, and it's a combination of visual and hearing.
Is it random, or can you call upon it at will?
No, I can call upon it at will.
Mm-hmm. Does it come all the time, whether you like it or not, or do you have control over it?
Oh, no. I learned a long time ago that you have to turn it off.
You're driving crazy, won't it?
You have to. Every professional psychic I've ever spoken to, this says that the first thing that you have to learn is to turn it off, because otherwise it'll just overwhelm you.
Yeah, I had that very same experience.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Well, listen, I want you to tell, we're about out of time, and I'd like for you to tell everybody one more time your name, your website, where they can find you.
Well, thank you. My name is Lori Nadell, and you can reach me at www.unlockyoursixthsense.com, and you can go to unlockyoursixthsense.com/letter.html for the bonus offer if you buy Sixth Sense on Barnes & Noble now. Or you can call me at 212-647-1134.
Thanks so much, Lori. And I want you to come back sometime and tell us about that 9/11. I mean, you must have some amazing stories.
Oh, I would love that. There were a lot of very unusual phenomena around that time, including an angel that appeared to me a few days before, which is really quite, you know.
What happened there?
Well, on September 9th, around midnight, I was finishing up. I was writing a story for the Times, the New York Times, and my daughter came in, and she got into bed with the cat, and she was asleep. I shut the computer down, and I went into the bedroom, and an angel appeared. And she put her wing over my daughter and the cat, and she said, "No matter what happens, I will keep you and your daughter safe." And I looked at her, and I said, "You're in my imagination, right? I mean, I'm making you up." And she smiled and she said, "No, I'm real." And then the whole room just burst into this golden white light.
That's amazing.
And then 2 days later, you know, the planes hit the building. And my daughter was really quite, you know, she wanted to put everything in the car and, you know, drive to Canada or Mexico. And,
yeah, I can
and
imagine.
Just, it was terrifying for all of us. But I still remember when I told her about the angel, she... I think I'm like the least likely person that an angel would appear to.
Right.
But maybe that's why she came to me. And, you know, my daughter kind of looked at me. She goes, "Really? An angel came to you?" I said, "That's what she said. She said she'd keep you safe." So we stuck it out.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You hear these stories from random people on the street, and you want to say they're crazy. But when you hear all of these people with all of these credentials that didn't believe in it to begin with. I mean, you have to think about it.
Yeah.
You have to think
about it, and it really is quite wonderful.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. You were a great guest.
Oh, thank you for the lovely conversation, and very, very generous of you to have me on.
Thanks, and agape to you.
Thank you, and you too.
Good night.
Good night.
Radio. 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 Radio.